Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
If I had $1 million.
Well, North Bay Station Jackson. I'm Tim Out. And on the board, SP Futures up 32. NASDAQ Futures up 152. So it looks like we're off to the races here this morning. Yesterday was a odd day. We're way down into the show. Some of that, I mean, you never really know, was probably due to the stuff going on in the Strait of Hormuz. And it appears that cleaned up. Then we ran all the way to the upside. Then we came back down and finished almost unchanged. So it was a, I don't know, volatile day, but at the history will reflect, it wasn't much of a day, but it actually was something of a day. We got oil up $1.46 this morning. We got gold rallying back up where they even got clobbered yesterday. So we have Professor Kevin.
Yeah, good morning.
How are you?
Well, I'm doing all right.
The interesting world we live in. All kinds of people dying. Robert Duvall, Jesse Jackson. Seems like... does that mean Jesse's kid's gonna? We're gonna have two kids in the house because he died. Is that how that's gonna work out? Probably. Not so sure.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. It has a lot to do with it. I think it's more of the influence already gained.
I don't think it hurts, but anyway, we'll see. I don't know the one. This is the kid who was already in jail for stealing when he was in last time. Running again because his brother's already in. His brother got the, he was running against our friend Karen Reeves. He got the million plus from, what's his name? Reed?
Bankman Fried.
Yeah. And I don't think he ever gave it back. Just saying. Yeah. Or gave it to charity. I think he kept it. So there you go.
Yeah.
It's, I
think a lot of the slime ball brigade understands that that a whole lot of what you do will blow over. You know that we have as a society, we have a fairly short attention span, and everybody will be outraged for a while, but it'll eventually pass.
Sure you can sure. As I keep going down the list, and I sent, not that you guys hadn't already read it, the list of all these people caught up in this Epstein thing, and I'm stunned by the amount of women that are involved. I don't know why it should be. I guess it's the new world. I'm just not part of it. But
yeah, and just to sort of correct the record from yesterday, when I texted you, I did not text you something that said, "Hey, it's a Democrat thing." I actually said it's a what's her name from Goldman Sachs was there, and you seemed a little puzzled by that, just like you were just now, and I said, no, she's politically connected. That's the big thing is if you had the connections, then Epstein was interested.
Well, question is, which side was interested? You know, if you're, is it a Goldman Sachs thing? If you know somebody's the world's biggest money launderer and you're this...
What's Lutnick's background from the business world? Because he's up to his neck, and
he was Cantor Fitzgerald,
and he should be gone. He should be out of the administration. It's funny, the private sector is cleaning up and getting people out of there. The public sector is not.
I don't know much about his background. I can say that I have a client who knows a lot of clients that know a lot of people. For those who don't know, I'm not 100%. Up to speed on the kind of Cantor Fitzgerald situation, except that the big story is they had the top I'm going to say two or three floors in World Trade Center as their world headquarters. So when the plane hit, I think, you know, I can't give you the whole, you know, the chart of all the management, but a real lot of people in the high end of Cantor Fitzgerald, which is a huge organization, didn't make it. So Lednick was obviously not one of those people. From what I understand, you know, he did well afterward.
Right, but he's also a guy who you know, did visit the island after he had been convicted. That's the kind of thing that is getting people canned out of the private sector, and in European countries is getting them canned out of government. It's getting them pushed out of government.
Well, he
Have that. I mean, the same thing. It would be Lutnick. It would be, you know, like Hakeem Jeffries. Same thing. You know, he's out there soliciting money from a guy who's a already convicted as a pedophile. So. You know, there's a whole lot of sliminess involved in here, but in terms of, you know, why would he be interested in some of these people is because they have influence, they have political pull, not just within their corporations, but within the political system itself.
I just, the logistics of it, and I, you know, I guess I don't care enough to dig into it, but how do you, it's kind of one thing if, guy's got a nice big apartment in Chicago and your family's in town, you head over for lunch and he's got a big balcony, it's a nice day. How the hell do you just happen to be going by Epstein's Island with your family, your kids, your nannies? Didn't he have a couple of neighbors' kids and their nannies? I mean, how do you just, was he on some big boat that he owns, or did they fly in, or nothing? I mean, it just the whole thing seems preposterous to me. What does your kid say when he sees this in the paper? Hey, Pops, couldn't we go to McDonald's? I mean, what the hell? I keep, as soon as I think about it, I'd be in the car listening to the, what's the new dating relationship? It's just lunch? Where it's no, like, big deal if, like, if you have two people downtown and looking to meet? Hey,
that's a service that's been advertising for 25 years.
So what do I think of this Lednick guy lugging the whole family and all these people there? What are they? Did they cook out hot dogs on the grill? I mean, the whole thing seems so bizarre to me. So different than my world. I can't even go there.
Yeah. So again, hard to understand, hard to explain away relationships like that, where people, if they didn't know, they should have known, and probably did know. And like I said, it's just insight into the. Into the ethics of the people involved, and where they're willing to compromise themselves, let alone how compromised they may be from whatever was going on with Epstein. So, you know, if we can clean that out, that would be great. I don't envision it happening though.
Well, I don't, Kevin, maybe it's because of obviously our talks and everything, but maybe it's because of. You know, Wayne's influence on me, that I keep thinking that there's more to this. I mean, I don't think anybody's accusing Lutnick of showing up with his family and sneaking in the back room and messing around with a 15-year-old while he claimed he was going to the men's room. I mean, there's way more to this. The money laundering, the foreign connections, the way to get into, to tell the Russian Secret Service about yourself. There's something here that we're just not getting, and that's why Wayne's convinced 80% of it had nothing to do with the little girls. I mean, it had to do with the who are these people? I mean, they keep talking about somebody, you know, who, you know, maybe it was the Mossad, maybe it was, you know, who the hell knows? Videos of all the, you know, people from Saudi Arabia, you know, messing around with little girls and drinking and eating shrimp when you're not supposed to drink if you're, you know, I guess if you're a you know, Muslim or something. Still to this day, we haven't exactly come across who's the keeper of the films. Obviously, there must still be something. I mean, who's in the background here? Somebody that was predated Epstein. Somebody that must have been involved with what's his name's father, Bush and... attorney Barr's father. Somebody had to be involved in Maxwell's dad. Going back, is it still the Mossad? Is it still the CIA? Is it still Russian? Somebody is in charge of all this crap, and I don't think the name's anywhere out there yet. And that's kind of what Wayne has been digging at it. That the young girl part is just a sort of a sleazy cover to. I don't think the guy from Lutnick went there because of the girls. I don't think for a second. And I don't think the lady from Goldman Sachs, who was in the Obama administration. I don't think that she was all over this guy. Was it part of her job to know what was going on because of Goldman? Did she do it on her? It sounded like she actually had a thing for Epstein, which is even more bizarre. But was it all that? Did she go there because she liked the guy's picture in the paper, or because Goldman expected her to find out what was going on over there? I mean, to me, the questions are just piling out. And it's not about, Summers obviously looking for a girlfriend through Epstein because he couldn't find one on his own. I think that's the interesting, I guess, prurient part. I think it's 20%
that's
of the deal.
The salacious part, and in some cases, that's really significant. Or it's important. Let's put it that way. But it really is when you can compromise people in lots of different ways, and sex is only one of them. But when you can compromise people, then you have influence over policy. And did Epstein want to influence policy? Maybe not. Probably not. He was probably a conduit for people who did want to influence policy. And I think that's where the real power is.
Well, Kevin, everybody always laughs when I say the theme of the show, which is of zero import really to anybody, but it's everything depends on everybody else. I mean, we often have talked about political contributions, and we talk about them in a way that I don't think I don't understand them as much as I think I do, or think maybe I should, because whenever I can't explain something from the downward sense side, I remain confused. No, other people don't have that problem with themselves, but if I'm, let's pick somebody I know supports judges. Now, whether or not they support them, like State Farm, they're an Illinois corporation. They used to be a mutual agency, but not anymore. So they're going to support, if Kevin O'Neill's running for judge and they like you, they're going to support you. Okay, well, that's the American way, right? Well, now, if they're going to support all these judges, say 30 of them, or I don't know what the number is, are they just getting a Rolodex, essentially, of people that if a case ever lands in front of Kevin O'Neill, they can... It's sort of like The Godfather. I may ask you for a favor, I may never ask you for a favor. Is it just card, put people in your Rolodex, your files, whatever you want to call it. Same thing with the, 50 Arabs, 150 Arabs, God knows how many, go to this guy's place in New York or Florida or on the island, and they're seen, boozing it up, having a good time, messing around with young girls, which is everything against, the Muslim religion, pretty much. Now, do you just file it someplace in case the guy ever gets in power over there and wants to do something, and you say, look what I got on you. Is it just sitting there like a little time bomb waiting to go off, just like a political contribution? I'm guessing so, but I don't know. I mean, you don't, every single guy you film, you don't tell him the next day you filmed him, do you? I don't think that would be the right way to do it. You wait till you need him, or you wait till he's going to do something against you, right? Say, oh, by the way, look what I got on you. I mean, I don't... I mean, this is the thing I'm curious about. I mean, I'd love your insight. I mean, what are we doing here? I mean, I don't think they told everybody. I think they have stuff on people. Somebody's got a catalog someplace that people are wondering if they're in it, I think, right now, and they're worried about it.
Well, do you if you remember a couple of weeks ago when people went into the SCIF and to view the files and to scan the files, I think one of the things that they were after when they were logging the searches for people is not just people, not just, you know, politicians going in there and saying, oh, is my name in there? Oh, crap. I think you had people in there searching for names of constituents who said, would you find out if I'm in there, please? You know, so I think, you know, there's a whole protection racket that goes with this.
Well, there could be. I mean, I'm assuming the guy was a Democrat because looked like he was Hispanic. Representative went in there and he did his 2 hours and he came out.
He doesn't necessarily mean Democrat anymore.
Well, but I'm saying I think he was a Democrat. But he went in, he came out and he said, I saw so much stuff in there. He goes, I'm going to go report it to my committee. I'm not even going to tell you guys what I found. It's horrible. He wouldn't talk. He goes, I'm going to go to my committee and let them know. The committee sent a few of us to go and look at stuff. I did. I found what I found is horrifying. I'm going to back report to their committee. I'm not going to tell you guys who got back in the car. I'm okay then. Like, what the hell does that mean? I'm sure the committee's Republican and Democrat, right?
Yeah.
I like the part where he goes, here's my phone, leaving it in the car, and, like, drops it on the seat when he goes in there. Evidently, you can't bring your phone.
No, you definitely can't bring your phone, because they don't want people taking pictures and stuff.
And so, you know, and so there's obviously more here than, I hate, like, hell to say we need some sort of a commission, good Lord. But we have had commissions in this country that have done, I think, pretty interesting work, and sometimes...
It's all grandstanding now.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most amazing things is we talked, I don't know what got us on the subject a while ago, Kevin, but it was the John Flanagan and I were talking about the Kerner Report. And after all the riots... In 68, the riots, we had riots all the time. Riots in 68, Otto Kerner was he's a singularly talented guy, I think, in a lot of ways. He ended up going to jail for racetrack stock, which I think was totally trumped up, but that's another story. They put this thing together about the causes and so forth of the 68 riots after Martin Luther King, you know, which is cogent because Jesse Jackson was with him when he got shot. And they basically did this thing about how governmental programs and things that were happening were going to end up forming this permanent underclass. And these are the things you need to do. You can't be doing what you're doing. And the thing was it Johnson or somebody absolutely couldn't stand the report because it was a scathing, serious work on what governmental policies was doing to families and doing to Black and other poor people. And I bet if you read it today, Kevin, it would sound like it was yesterday. And I think that's one of the reasons why Kerner ended up in jail, is this report. And I can't prove it.
It takes us back to, what happens if you're compromised and you don't play ball?
Yeah. But, you know, someplace somewhere...
Or if they can compromise you if you're not compromised. So, you know...
And you know, who are the people... Who couldn't wait to get Gary Hart into the plus? Or who went after Elliot Spitzer? Elliot Spitzer was, to a certain extent, could have been our generation's Roosevelt.
Well, and Gary Hart was a different case because he self-destructed just as much as anything.
Yeah.
So he's a little bit different case. His bigger sin was arrogance.
Well. Arrogance in a politician, but there's a level of...
I know. Okay, so maybe it wasn't the arrogance, it was the lack of self-awareness about his arrogance.
Well, I think he...
Inability to check it when he needed to.
Yeah, I mean, he gave the reporters a bunch of grief. But I'm also of the opinion that when you enter that fray and you know people are out to get you, you can't give them ammunition.
No kidding.
But it's... Kind of hard to do for some people. I mean,
you can't have monkey business.
What fun
you
is it?
That reference? You get that right? That was the name of the boat.
I don't. You know, I get. You know, everybody has different. Whatever I'm going to say, everybody has different wants and needs in life. And I was. I don't know. Maybe some people will say, you know, what's wrong with you or something, but. I was never in that group, Kevin, where I just in the midst of my best day, I had to go find some lady behind the bleachers and risk it all. I don't know if I didn't have enough testosterone or what it was, but or enough arrogance. That would never have been me, and I don't think it would have been anybody else on the show. I mean, it's just something, but some people just have to do it, and I don't. It's almost like it's at that point it can't even really be sex. It has to be proven you can do it, or proven you're above the law, or something. Or not the law, or the common law, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, you know what? What possesses somebody to have sex with somebody else on their wedding day? Which people do. I mean, that whole thing. I think you know, enjoyed sex when we were younger, Kevin, as much as anybody. But I never was that way. I just. Wait a minute. I think I'll try
and. An age group thing, Tom.
What? It's a, you know, I'll try. Even though I really like my wife or my girlfriend, I'm going to go out and try and mess with somebody else to try and screw with her. I mean, I just never. But some people have this amazing drive. I mean, look at Kennedy, for God's sake. The guy's half dying, and he's doing somebody every day. I mean, with his back, with his disease, what was his disease?
Addison's disease.
You're lucky if you can make it to breakfast. The guy's got to go find somebody every day. I mean, part of you wants to say, wow. Part of you wants to say, what are you doing? I don't know. I guess everybody's different. What can I tell you? But
okay, different subject.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting. Do you know that of the 1,500 largest publicly traded firms, about 1 in 9 got a new chief exec last year?
I did not know that, and now I'm sitting there thinking, why?
Highest rate since 2010. And the average age of the incoming CEOs has fallen by about 2 years, which is a significant, you know, from 56 to 54, which is somewhat of a significant jump. Not, you know, not a huge difference between age 56 and 54, but when you start looking at the averages, that means a lot of younger execs coming on board. As CEOs, so that's kind of interesting. And so, yeah, the question is why? Would you have any speculation? I don't think we have a definitive explanation, and I have some ideas, but do you have any thoughts about why that may be?
If I put on my tin hat, I wonder if, because the prices of these stocks, in one man's opinion, even though obviously I'm very happy we're up today because I have clients that are long. I wonder if the price of these stocks are causing people to get out and be able to take their options and all their stuff while the getting's good.
Okay, so that might explain some of the departure. That's interesting. That would be, I could see that being a factor in there.
Do we have more mergers and acquisitions where guys are just out? That I don't think anywhere near the number you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't think we're looking at, we still have some very substantial mergers and acquisitions, but I don't see the rapid fire like we saw.
No, I don't either. I was going to say, I don't think that's probably a few cases, but nothing like you're talking about. Actually, yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon. I do think a lot of it is rapid technology change, and the need for people who really understand it better. So you may be seeing that as a factor, and I can envision that being true, where people are just stepping aside and saying, I really can't cope with the pace of technology. Also, if we are really seeing a reshoring boom, then I would say. And I've talked about this before, that if you are bringing more businesses back into the U.S., you still have to compete with the low labor costs of overseas. And so to the extent that you're doing that, the direction of your company has to be tied into automation. Because if, it's the only way you're going to, let's go to the theoretical 100% automated production line. When you do that, the marginal cost of making a product is near zero. Now it works its way off of zero from there, but automation actually reduces the unit cost. The swap for that is capital expenditure. And so, you know, the question then becomes, how fast can you recover your capital expenditure? And that, of course, explains the 1 year policy that's in the most recent tax bill, that is saying you can recover all of your you can do your full cost recovery of opening a new factory in 1 year, which allows you to accelerate the recovery, even though it's just displacing. It's displacing the tax burden. It's reducing it in the first year. It will increase in subsequent years, but it makes sense. But if you're going to come in and you're going to get into automation, then perhaps the person who's been in charge for the last 15 years is not the one who's going to drive that initiative.
I would say it might just be a generational thing. And again, in Stocks and Jacks, why does damn near every coach get fired every year because he didn't win the Super Bowl? I mean, does anybody really? Is it just because your stock price isn't Nvidia last year, or I was gonna say Amazon, but they were down 20 days in a row, so I'm gonna use that as an example. Is it just our stock didn't go up 30% last year? We got to fire the guy. I mean, it could be some of that too. And you know,
not really firing him. Most of them are stepping down. Now, you know, that could be stepping down under pressure. Yeah. Granted.
The constant. How? Why isn't our stock up 20% this year, Matt? You know, it's
but
funny.
We're not seeing that many public dismissals, you know, that where they're just saying so-and-so was forced out.
You know, when you mention this, and you hear this pretty much constantly, and it's all about, you know, the low labor rates and this kind of thing in this country and or in other places, that's one small piece. I'm not accusing you of this because I know you know the story. It's one small piece of somebody who could give a lecture in labor economics. The idea that that somebody in, let's say, South Korea, making blue jeans, the cost of labor kind of ought to be, the theory, not just the theory, if allowed to practice properly and companies weren't big enough to control the market and governments didn't help them, a person should be paid essentially some percentage of what they're worth to the employer. And we've been steered, brainwashed as a country here to not even know what I'm talking about. I mean, if you and I go into a machine shop and we're machine operators and all of a sudden they pay us $30 an hour, and by the way, the crap we're putting out is worth $200 an hour, we can demand a raise. And you know, in theory, the last person makes as much as his marginal gain to the firm. Okay, so if you say Chief and Kevin are putting up a factory here to make widgets, and we find a spot in Indiana, we find a spot, who knows, we find a spot in Chicago. Guess what? The power is cheap. We got enough land. We've got transportation right here. We got all the factors of production that help labor do whatever they do to where that guy is actually worth, because of all the stuff we can get to him, he's worth, you know, $100, $200 an hour and stuff to me. Now, granted, a lot of it is the power, a lot of it is the other stuff. So we're going to pay him, you know, 40, 50, some real number. And by the way, everybody's sort of happy because the guy's a skilled person, he's doing this stuff. And I'm going back to, you know, I know this is Mayberry a little bit, but the idea that that guy somehow is the same guy somewhere else where there's no power, there's not a whole lot of land, maybe there's no heating and air conditioning in a place. And for our guy to say, well, boy, what if our guy made $4 an hour? Well, that'd be nice. I'd love to pay people $4 an hour that were, and we don't have a lot of any guys in the firm here to hawk commissions on people, but if I could pay somebody $4 an hour that every time he made a put down a phone call, I got a $500 trade, well, that'd be cool. That'd be real cool, wouldn't it? But that's not the way economics works. So when people say,
how does the economics work for the labor market?
It right now, I'm not so sure it does, but it ought to work. In other words, the idea that there's only 35 hours of labor in an automobile. We're already where people are to the point where they are essentially doing the stuff that they absolutely have to do, that they make the most advantage to the firm, or they're maintaining the robots and other stuff in the places that are easy for the robots. So we're kind of already there. To turn around and say, gee, this guy should make $3 an hour like in China, it's not exactly an even thing. I mean, there's a lot more factors of production than just one person. It's like saying, you know, if we could just cut the electricity rate to zero. Well, yeah, but you can't. You know what I'm saying? There's much more that goes into this. I mean, a lot of people here would much rather have a factory here paying people $35 an hour and having somebody gain from it, because you got a nice big spot, you got power, you got all the other stuff, you got water, you got everything else, than sticking them some in some town. I've never been to Korea, but some place where they don't have any of that stuff. Of course the guy here is going to be worth more than the guy there. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, but part of the reason you're worth it is because assuming that as a worker you have an alternative, if I can walk, if you're not paying me enough, then I can walk.
That's all part of it, yeah.
And so, you know, it depends on what the market is for my skills. And the market for my skills for making fries is not the same as the market for my skills for doing preventative maintenance on the equipment on the production line.
But who can you walk? I mean, if I would say that it...
Right, that's your question. And if you don't have alternatives, then the cost of the price for your labor is going to be suppressed.
Well, that's the part that is a problem. Okay, because now if you and I worked at the Walmart out in the southwest suburbs, and we're in the tire department, and all of a sudden the two of us, I have to believe, Kevin, even though we're not 25 anymore, that if you and I were in charge of the tire department, I'm going to say in 6 months, that tire department's going to be selling a hell of a lot more tires. We're going to get a name for ourselves. People are going to say, gee, I went over there, and these two guys seem to know a hell of a lot about tires. And that's where I'm going to go for my tires. And all of a sudden now we're worth, and they're paying us, whatever, $20 an hour. And we go to Walmart and we say, hey, guys, look what we've done to your business. We need a little goose here. Oh, no, we pay $20 an hour. Well, in that area, I could probably name you five or six other tire joints. Yes, we can walk. What if we couldn't? Walmart...
Stuck. Walmart's willing to pay you.
But we're not just stuck. Walmart's the beneficiary of this. I'm not accusing Walmart, but I'm saying the thought of them all of a sudden say, gee, we're going to give you guys, you know, 0.5% every tire you sell, they're not going to do that, I don't think. That's not the corporate way.
Yet they might, especially if they fully grasp the cost of turnover, too, because I'm not saying, and in the micro sense, that's you and me leaving, but in the macro sense, that's persistent turnover, which is very expensive. Because if you were to draw a productivity curve and you said, let's plot productivity over time, what's your productivity day one?
But you
walk into a brand new job, what's your productivity day one?
But the...
What's your productivity day one, Tom?
I'm probably zero.
Zero or near zero, right? So that's, you know, that's where you're stuck. And then you start working your way, along that curve, getting a little more productive, over time. Well, if you happen to leave and you have worked there for 3 months and you're not the most productive employee yet in the mix, but you're well along, you've become a pretty darn good employee, and they don't recognize that and they let you walk, then what do they replace you with?
Well, okay,
what did they replace you with?
A new guy.
A new guy whose productivity is back to near zero.
Okay, but
when you suffer a lot of turnover, and this is the part of the equation people don't get. I think everybody understands that turnover is expensive, but they think of it in terms of, well, I got to recruit people, that costs money, I got to train people, that costs money. It's really in the persistent low productivity that you get with a lot of turnover. And so if you can reduce your turnover rate substantially by partly, yes, part of that is paying well, but paying well doesn't satisfy people. It just pisses them off when you don't pay them well. But also creating good working environment, all those kinds of things, then what you do is even if you're not able to pay top dollar, you make it a tough decision for people to leave. The lower your turnover rate, the more productive your operation is, the more profitable it is. That is that is pretty standard business economics. And, you know, I think that's, you know, so when we start talking about the market for labor, those kinds of things are big factors.
All right, I have to disagree, and not just to disagree, although we both are good at that. First of all, I agree with everything you just said. That's all common sense. Just like what I said about if we're the best hire guys around, there needs to be a whole lot of flexibility. But how do you explain, I know of two companies, well, I think I know of two companies, that got a lot more money than we do, Kevin, and they don't care. UPS has had turnover forever. One of Audrey's friends worked in one of these Amazon distribution centers. They didn't give a crap if you were there a year. If they'd give you, they'd still give you the worst hours, even if they were, you were one of their best people, never did, not didn't show up always. They could care less. And I don't know how they, is it they're just so big in other areas, or they got such a monopoly, or what it is. Everything you just said, they didn't do, and yet they seem to be doing all right. Or well, I don't know, both their stocks getting clobbered. But I mean, they did exactly the opposite of what you and I would say is the right thing to do, and yet UPS has been doing that for 50 years. They don't
have. Sometimes I think that there's an understanding at the corporate level, but there is not an understanding at the plant manager type of level, or even down the line to the manager supervisor level. I think you know the problem there is that so many people in leadership roles are just dumbasses, and they don't really understand it, and as a result, you know, they're more interested on controlling people than they are on understanding how to build good teams and how to be very effective. And I think the ones that are very effective, the ones that do understand that, are the ones who thrive and move up the corporate ladder, at least in most places.
I think somehow, Kevin, if these places catch fire, I mean, give an example of, let's talk about Andrew. He's here on the board. Andrew worked, do you have one of those Canes places down by you? I've never been in the place, but he worked there for a while.
Yeah, I have. Did I go there once when it opened? I don't remember. Whatever it was unimpressive.
Well, I'm gonna give you Andrew's kind of story. And so Andrew gets there. Andrew's a pretty bright lad, nice to people. And all of a sudden, they put him in the management. Say, how would you like to do some management training? Okay. So he becomes a manager at his place. Then they took him, I don't know, 2-3 weeks. He went down to Michigan City and helped open up another store. All this kind of stuff, and there's in his place by Wrigley Field, there's 3 or 4 people. Again, I mean, it might be 2 or 6, I don't know, but there's 3 or 4 people that are on this essentially management track. They change the person in charge of the area. Not one of these people ever gets an offer to do anything. And all of a sudden, Andrew in the field said, "We don't want to be a manager anymore." And then, the person goes even further. That if you're, quote, a manager, even though they're not giving you any kind of title, we're now, you might be working from 6 in the morning to noon on Tuesday, and on Wednesday from 6 at night to 2 in the morning without any sort of regular hours, because now you're, quote, a manager making 50 cents more an hour. And finally, like, 3 or 4 of the people quit because they go, this sucks. Like, at least for my 30 hours, give me something regular. They won't even do that. So the people that they essentially invested money on are all gone because they changed it. I think there's way, you're probably right, Kevin, it's just bad management, but it's way more insidious than we think, you know.
Yeah, and I think that the scenario goes sort of like this, where they'll approach Andrew and they say, "You're smart, you do good work, you seem to get along with people, how would you like to be a supervisor or a manager?" And that's great. Andrew, you can tell me if that's not true, but you can say, "Well, how much you pay?" They tell you, "Okay, I'll pay you a little bit more." Cool, I'll do it because I want to make more money. But if you don't have the foundations that you need, if nobody has ever developed in you the foundations that you need to be a successful leader, then you have to hope to God that person just adapts. That person just figures it out on the fly, unless you have a really, really great management training program, great leadership development program, because if you don't, and things don't go smoothly because nobody has ever given you those foundations, you're not going to succeed. And if you don't succeed, what are they going to do then? You got drafted to do this job because you're a really good employee. What are they going to do? Bust you back down to the old job? Well, that's not very motivating. So now you've got a disgruntled employee, or you're going to walk them out the door. You just took one of your good employees, set them up to fail, and then perp walked them out the door. That's not good either. That's the state of a lot of management, especially in retail and restaurant types of businesses. It's not very sophisticated. It's really, really dumb. And then you throw in all the things that a lot of managers in those businesses do: play favorites, get on, you know, do some power trip and all those kinds of things. And you start doing that, and it's no wonder that, you know, that you have high turnover rates.
Well, I think it's sort of an, you know, when people don't take management class, and plus I don't think the companies care, Kevin, from the top down. I don't know how many managers are actually ever going to a store. And, I mean, they're not Ray Kroc. The one who went into a McDonald's, first thing he did was walk into the bathroom to see if it was clean.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not, these guys are not.
I spent a long time, you know, yelling at CEOs, even CFOs, and saying, get your butt out to the shop floor. Find out what's going on out there. Talk to people. You know, you're gonna walk around. It might seem awkward right off the bat because you haven't really learned how to relate, you know, to the person on the shop floor so well. But you know what? If you start asking people, how's it going? What's going on? What are they going to say the first time? Oh, it's fine. You know, everything's fine. But sooner or later, someone's going to say, well, you keep asking me. Okay, let's talk about it.
Kevin, we got a few minutes. Can I mind if I jump gears on you? Maybe I'm trying to, you know, for years.
Sir, I just wanted to say for just a moment, I wasn't a jump in there, but I don't mean to.
No, fire away.
The conversation.
I just wanted to say from Kane specifically. That was my first time going into a management position, and there they were very, very good at being like, you know, teaching and telling me how to do everything right. And they are specifically, Tom mentioned, you know, like a new higher up manager had come in. She was very big on, like, you know, I wouldn't say once a week or whatever, but very often she comes in and Kane's essentially is like a checklist for everything. There is a standard and a correct way to do every single thing, whether it's cleaning, handling employees, whatever. And what really made me mad in the end, what made me leave, was like that playing favorites and such like that and stuff like that. Yeah. That is what other people were doing, and then it was a lot of the managers just treated the crew like cattle, for lack of a better word.
I'm better than you are.
Yeah, yeah, and
I'm a boss. I'm better than you are.
Exactly, and I'm like, I hate that. Like, I hated it so much, and I was like my golden rule was like, I would never ask someone to do something or tell someone not to do something if I wasn't able to do that myself. Like,
Andrew, I'm totally with you on that. And I used to, you know, tell give you a different example. I had, back in my IT days, we would have nighttime who's on call, and, you know, we could program the phone system to automatically ring somebody's cell phone, wake them up in the middle of the night if there was some kind of network problem. I always did my 2-week shift of being on call, even if I couldn't solve half of the problems. And I'd have the team say to me, geez, Kevin, you don't have to do this. And I'd say, yes, I do. I have to do it because you have to do it. And you're right. You know, you don't ask people to do things that you won't do. I don't ask people to stay late to do a system installation or come in on Saturday and do a system installation unless I'm going to be there with them, even if my only job is to bring them lunch. You know, it's just one of those team building things, and you innately have, you know, you got it. I think those are all factors. But yeah, I think the state of leadership, and leadership development, I think, you know, in many cases, people just aren't aware. Like I said, we got people who are dumbasses, and they don't really get the implications of what they do wrong. But once you start to enlighten people a little bit, it really becomes more about it, it's less about me being in a leadership role than it is about building great teams. Because it turns out that if you go build great teams and people like working for you and all of that, that gets noticed. That's what gets you promoted.
Hey, Kevin, we're almost running out of time here, but on Friday, if you want, I mean, because you guys are my tech guys. So I'm stunned or curious, whatever you want to call it. For a long period of time, you could sort of look, and again, this is a little half-assed, but you could sort of look at the top seven tech companies that were driving the world. Not that they were all up or down the same every day, but you could sort of, they moved as kind of a unit. And now, in the last 8 to 10 to 12 weeks, that has become totally unglued in the sense that the tech is hanging in there, but God help you if you have Microsoft. God help you if you have Amazon. God help you if you have Oracle. Yet, if you have Micron, you're fat and happy. And the delineation in the, I'll use the term, crowd, is becoming so crazy that I used to be you could buy kind of one of them and you were in the group, not to a total extent. What is starting to cause that? Is it all about somebody spending too much for AI, somebody's not involved, is it all AI, or is AI just a cover for other problems?
Well, AI is a cover for other problems. I absolutely believe that. And we saw that. There was a big hiring boom post-COVID, and I think they overdid it, a lot. And a lot of companies now are trying to bail out of their high expense ratios, and they're just blaming AI for it. And, that gets me off the hook. I don't look like an idiot. I'm just adapting my company for the brave new world. So I think that's a big part of it. But I also think we're starting to figure out who is and who isn't an innovation company. And Microsoft's a classic example. I've been saying for a while, they aren't the innovation company they once were. Not Microsoft, Apple. Apple's the other one. Apple's not the innovation company it once was. Microsoft never was exactly what I'd call an innovation company. They were really good at stealing technology. And Steve Jobs once said, good artists create, great artists steal. So Microsoft was really good at that. But I think when you start looking at the likes of Apple, what have they done that's truly innovative lately?
They have not much, but they have such a cash cow behind them. I mean, obviously, they're not going to go to zero. But
cash cows are great, but yeah. Cash cows don't last forever. You need to be you need a strong position in growing markets.
Well, they're all priced. They're all priced as a growth firm too, which is part of what you're saying.
Yeah, and people are starting to realize that not everybody is a growth firm. Not everybody's in they may be in a growth market, but, is their position dwindling in that growth market, or is something else going on that's inhibiting them? But I just don't see the same degree of innovation from some of the long-standing tech leaders that I've seen in the past. And maybe that's just the way it's going to be. Maybe we have, maybe we're starting to see a little bit of a rumbling where we have to figure out who it's going to be, but we have a whole new group of people who are coming in and being the innovators that are going to drive what's next.
What you just mentioned, Kevin, is one of my many decades in the business, is one of the most fascinating, curious things that still keeps me here. Well, obviously my clients keep me here, but when somebody becomes, it's priced like it's basically the cat's ass. It's growing, and it is growing, and then it's priced, beyond the dreams of avarice. And then all of a sudden, there's this growth company, there's this innovator. And all of a sudden, someday, they're just not. They're just like everybody else. And all of a sudden, the stock, not all of a sudden, but over a period of time, the stock gets, priced like eBay. They were the most innovative place in the world. You couldn't, if you shorted that thing, you got carried out feet first every month. And all of a sudden, one day, they look like another retailer to me, kind of a thing. And you can never, trying to time that change in sentiment is one of the most fascinating things I've ever tried to do. I mean, it's not like I'm good at it or anything, but I don't think anybody is. But it is what, like you say, okay, I'm a Microsoft is now a place. I'm not saying that that's Microsoft's a place where now they're going to start paying me a 2 or 3% dividend, and they're going to make 8 or 10% every year, and they sound like a pretty damn good company to me, but they're not going to be priced at, 15 times revenue. I mean, it's just not what they're priced at. And it, when that all changes, and when how people's, how their attitude changes, is really one of the most fascinating things in the market.
Well, it is, and the question is who's also able to shift. And yeah. An example there would be, like a Comcast. And just look at it from the, from the nature of their business. How much do they charge nowadays for cable entertainment?
Oh, a lot. Try to get somebody off
it. A lot, yeah. Now they've started to adjust their pricing a little bit just to hang on, but that's been a cash cow for them for a long time because so few people have had options other than them, and now that there's streaming options for people, Comcast is realized they want to get as much as they can for as long as they can for their cable entertainment packages, and now that it has started to really dwindle significantly, they've gone ahead and started to adjust their pricing to squeeze it for a little while longer and see how much they can get out of it. That's cool. That's pretty standard stuff for how pricing works. But in the meantime, are they going to go out of business on that, or where have they focused themselves? So now, if you would have looked 5 years ago and seen any of their ads, what were they selling? Do you remember?
Well,
they were selling bundles.
Bundles. Yeah, they were selling bundles.
Get your voice, get your data, get get your landline type of style voice.
Matter of fact, my idiots called me twice yesterday. They wanted me, took my cell phone in with them and saved me. I mean, why would I want to do my, I got to think a decent cell phone deal. Why would I want to all of a sudden change to Xfinity cell phone? I don't know who the hell they even are. Is it worth a phone call?
Oh yeah, it probably is, because they're what they're doing. Who are the big dogs in cellular service? Well, it's Verizon, it's AT&T, and it's T-Mobile, and Xfinity is saying that's the growth market, especially with the 5G rollout and whatever's going to come after 5G. That's where the growth market is. So they know that they already have their entertainment market dwindling, and the next thing that's going to get that's going to start taking a lot of hits as more places get 5G, and they're already starting to see that, is that people are going to be switching their internet service to wireless and wireless internet gateways wireless 5G gateways, and they'll have all the bandwidth they get by pulling cable or fiber into their so as a result, that's where they're making the push. They're trying to compete with those big three and come up with the kind of bundles. And it's not just your cell phone. It is all of the other wireless services that can go with it, all of the stream services, et cetera.
Well, they still have a massive capital investment in coming into your house, and there's no way anybody is ever going to go to the city and make their capital investment again. So they have a monopoly there. Hey,
They do. It's just that people are going to start unplugging from it.
Well,
and so
every person
they fully recovered the cost of that. That's not a problem.
Every person the girl downstairs tried to do the T-Mobile 5G. She said it didn't work.
Oh, see, I know a lot of people who have made that switch and they love it.
All right. Well, hey,
it depends. It depends on how well built out 5G is in your area.
Well, it doesn't work in a garden apartment either, which is a problem.
Yeah, that you may have interference there. So, yeah.
Well, we're going to have to go to the other guys, but I'm going to make an announcement here, Kevin. I've read probably 5 articles about how these other countries pay more for metals than the U.S. And I read the article and I go, I don't want to call anybody a dumbo, but I guess I'm going to. I read the article and I go, what the hell is this? Singapore is going to pay, was it $1 million or $2 million for a gold medal? I'm going to go out on a limb and say Stocks and Jacks will pay every Stocks and Jacks contributor $20 million for a gold medal in the Olympics. What are the chances of me having to pay that off? I'm thinking probably zero. I don't see you in a figure skating outfit tonight.
You definitely do not.
I mean, so what if Singapore's never won a medal, have they? They could pay $20 million, $50 million. What's the difference?
And if they do, it's going to be such a big deal, it's worth it for them, the big payout.
Yeah. I mean, it's a... Did you see...
Because they're not paying out 10 of them. They're just going to pay out one.
Did you see your buddy from Saturday Night Live, Colin Jost, riding the back seat of the two-man bobsled just to see? He was...
Oh, no, I did not see that.
He was absolutely... When he got to the finish line, he goes, I had no idea. He goes, I don't even know if this guy's at a record pace. I'm getting jostled around and kicked around back there. I feel like somebody put me through a shaker. He goes, I've never felt anything like this. He goes, this is crazy. Couldn't wait to get out of there.
All right. Well, let me sign off. Turn it over to Doctors Larissa and Russell. And good morning and goodbye.
Doctors Larissa, Doctors Russell. How are you guys?
We're stepping away from watching all the luge to talk to you.
By the way, did you see that? What's it called? The skeleton? Where you? It's like the luge. Only you go down head first on your belly.
I think that's the one I want to do.
Wind up being
all those guys are like 31, 35 years old. The one guy was a landscaper.
Yeah,
they just want to be in the Olympics.
The true Olympic spirit.
Yeah,
that's why. You can finish your curling and then you can light up a fatty and probably still perform in the next round.
Well, yeah, except boy, oh boy. Do we have Larissa?
She's with us.
Good morning.
Larissa,
good morning.
Yeah, I know you're young, but there was just what we were talking about. There was a lady, I'm losing track of time, but it has to be 15, 20, maybe even longer years ago. And she was either from, I think she might have been from like East Germany or someplace. So probably, it was that long ago. And she, heavier lady, looked like, she walked off the Russian steps, right? And not disparaging anything, but she said she's watching the Winter Olympics and she goes, I want to win a gold medal in the Winter Olympics. So she looked at the figure skaters and went, nah. Looked at the skiers and went, nah. And then she saw the luge and she goes, I can do that. In like a year, she was winning races in the World Cup, and she ended up winning at least one or two gold medals. And she did what she picked the sport. It was sort of like if Russell and I picked curling or something. Something maybe we could do. It said,
I think that's about it.
That's about it.
I don't think there's anything other than curling that you... Although, I heard a rumor that esports might be hitting the Olympics eventually.
Esports.
I watched a documentary on esports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. It's video games, Chief. Go ahead.
Yeah, didn't some colleges have teams for a while?
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because these participants do physical training. So there's genuine, like they have exercise regimes, they have endurance tests, there's a lot to it because when you go into this gaming mode, the games are hours at a time. I'm also as fascinated by that it's a genuine team effort. So when they're looking at these multiplayer games, that you have specific roles on the team. And I don't remember all the different types of roles. However, there is, like a basketball game, right? You've got your forward, you've got your center, you've got your point guard, right? And you have all of these different individuals working together. And that's what happens in esports. My mind was blown. And I was also just overwhelmed by the amount of money that is poured into these esports.
Were some colleges given, didn't Loyola have a scholarship, Russell, on that for a while?
Yeah, that sounds like something they'd do.
Larissa, what's interesting is you can figure out who your center and your guard are. I can't figure out who they are in the Bulls after all these trades. I don't know who the centers and the forwards are in the Bulls. So maybe I should go to esports. I'd know better. Just saying.
So I have one of my students, this was a couple of years ago, in one of the classes, I forced the students to get up and have weekly speeches. And to get them warmed up, the first week I have them write a 1-minute speech and they have to write a paper to go along with it. And then they have to get up and present it. And I said, you can present it on anything you want. So one of my students wrote on how he changed his loyalty from the Chicago Bulls to the Milwaukee Bucks. And the first time around when he wrote it, it was very superficial, very shallow. And I explained you need to have facts of why you're doing this and everything. And all of a sudden he came back and he's got this, all of the records of why the Milwaukee Bucks were a better team to cheer for, how he really liked it. I want to say that at the time the coach was Scott Thibodeau.
Yeah.
And how he switched to the Milwaukee Bucks, about how there was a system of how they play. And again, everything was backed by facts, and it was fantastic. And afterwards, it was, you know, a fun class discussion of whether or not we should all be cheering for the Milwaukee Bucks as opposed to the Chicago Bulls.
Well, you want to follow the Bulls if you like the playground offense and the Olé defense.
There you go.
I don't know if those are styles necessarily, but what the?
It's what you get.
It's kind of what it's kind of what you get. But last week we had a big talk, we missed you, regarding people looking at the markets now and, you know, some of the, you know, God knows, the incredible amount of political information that bashes back and forth. I mean, yesterday is going to go down, you know, Russell 50 years from now is going to dig back on, what the hell was yesterday, the 17th, and it's going to say there was a nothing day in the market. Well, in fact, we were down, 300 and some in the NASDAQ futures yesterday morning, maybe because of the Strait Hormuz stuff, I don't know. Then all of a sudden that evidently wasn't an event. Then we went 100 points positive, then we went negative again and finished a little bit up. Well, it's going to say, well, there was a boring-ass day after a holiday. No, it wasn't. We had like a 450-point or 425-point NASDAQ move during the day. Is this market fabric? Is this just the news is changing back and forth? And then individual stocks, I used to ask Kevin, and Russell, we've been doing this for a long time, we'd always refer to the Magnificent Seven as kind of a group. Now, you know, we never really would explain to people that they're all the same stock, because they weren't, but they were considered tech. And now, every day, one of them is way down, one of them is way up. There's even a breaking apart in the tech people. This stuff is, the averages don't even begin to compute at the end of the day what's going on here. I mean, how do you guys pick that up, or do you, or how do you explain it? Don't all speak at once.
Sorry. I don't know that I necessarily, with my students, we talk a little bit about just the grouping of the tech stocks. But my students are usually not as necessarily focused in as the markets as they should be.
Well, they're young.
I'm teaching investments right now. And the big challenge that you have with the undergrads is they're all fascinated by the three or four stocks that are talked about all the time on CNBC, which the first thing I do is tell them to start watching Bloomberg instead of CNBC. But they're all fascinated by the high flyer stocks, so they're all fascinated by the things that are moving really quickly. And I had a kid outright, I was talking about asset allocation versus security analysis, which is just top down versus bottom up. As one kid, so, well, you know, how do you figure out what stock you're supposed to buy? And I went through the whole discounted cash flow valuation. You know, if you think you should make 12% off this stock, and he's like, I'm not talking about 12%. I'm talking about, you know, stocks that go up three or four times.
Oh yeah, well,
that's not really, you know, that's not normal investing. That's the stuff you see on TV. So I have to temper that a bit, which I think it's kind of disappointing for some of them. They think they're going to show up in the investments class and they're going to learn how, you know. And then, you know, I have a hedge fund background, so they think that I've got some, and, you know, I worked in an exchange, and they think I've got some sort of secret sauce. And if I did, I'd probably still be teaching college, but I sure wouldn't share the secret sauce with them.
Russell, if you had somebody really knew how to trade, somebody like Larissa, and said, you know, I'm going to guarantee you guys for the next 25 years, say they're all 40 years old, so you retire, I'm going to get you 7% a year for 25 years, which would be spectacular in any 25-year period, except for maybe the last. They're going to say, what do we want her for? What are we talking about? We want something to be up 300% in 1 year, like NVIDIA or some other places.
And I try to explain. I've actually talked about short squeezes and a few of those types of things that happen. But it much like you were talking about when we joined, the difficulty of catching those inflection points. That's the nightmare. I mean, I was with a hedge fund that was short real estate, and we were in 2007, 2008, and we were only about 6 months early. And just because that timing was off by about 6 months, we lost our biggest investor and missed the whole thing, even though we were dead on with it. And there are probably, a few dozen firms like that where they didn't have the ability to say, no, I'm not giving you your money back. when it became very difficult toward the end there. But that's the very difficult part of what we do, is the timing part and figuring out, what I know and what everybody else doesn't know and what's not priced in yet. That's the stuff that I really try to get across.
Well, yeah, and I some of the stuff now, and boy, it's kind of, it sort of begs the political question or the Times question. We have a lot of individual stock, a lot of people, a lot of our clients, since I'm one of the few people around that will do this, and we're pretty good at it, we'll manage individual concentrated stock positions for people. And based on their age, all the other kind of stuff, they're still working, we'll protect it to whatever degrees, we agree upon with the client. And lately, we seem to have, in the last few months, we have some of these international, I'll call them, a lot of these international consulting kind of places. One is like OMC, they're like the second or third biggest marketer in the world. One's ACN, which is the old Accenture, and we've IBM. All of a sudden, which to a large extent does a lot of consulting work, right? Still to this day.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 6 to 8 weeks, these stocks have been obliterated. IBM, not as much. And I'm sitting there going, okay, what doesn't somebody like? What am I reading through all the Trump prognostications and maybe not even that? What's going on in kind of, what's going on with attitude around the world? Is there something that all of a sudden every U.S. international consulting firm is getting shot in the foot? I mean, it became so obvious that in that little area that nobody wanted any part of it. And all of a sudden, nobody wants any part of Oracle after it was a high flyer. Somebody wants no part of Amazon. I mean, I'm saying that some price here, it's up today. The thing's down 20 days in a row. Microsoft's down $150. I mean, somewhere these little pockets, when the market appears, if you just look at the quote, the market looks fine. Yet, there's areas that are not fine. And I'm trying to figure out, is this a zero-sum game for me? It's always around to a certain extent, isn't it, Russell? But it seems like it's becoming way more accentuated now. Is it just me? Because I have these stacks.
Well, I think it's the markets have become so democratized, I think it's a word I heard a long time ago when electronic trading came along. But it's so easy for people to, flip. Heck, if I were driving to work right now and you told me something was going on in a stock that I'm interested in, I could pull over and make a trade and not miss a light cycle on my drive to work.
Yeah.
It's that easy to make a transaction. It's probably an extreme example. But that stuff right there creates that herding type of behavior. And the thing that you talked about with the consulting firms, somebody just blurted out at a conference or on TV, I'm not even sure where the initial comment came from, but the consulting area and software is the area that really is probably got the biggest threat due to AI. And and IBM is kind of a consulting software firm, and I think they got hit with those guys, as well. But you never know when all of a sudden, if the three of us were sitting around at Ceres talking about, who really is going to get hurt by AI. one of us probably would have come up with software on our own, you know, because it's just so much easier to get a computer to do the things that you want to do now with AI. Also, if you need, I needed the code for, I was programming something in Visual Basic yesterday, and I needed the code for something I hadn't done in a long time, and I asked AI and got the answer immediately. So, you know, anybody that programs, they need to, you know, maybe take a look in the mirror and make sure that they're going to be okay as far as things go professionally. But I do think we could have figured those out. It's just that all of a sudden the unwashed masses with their personal brokerage accounts all figured it out on the same day and bailed out. And I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if the people that were leading that bailout are the ones that were kind of our age and around for the internet thing bursting, because it was like a, you know, it was like a switch that got flipped in that case as well.
Well, I, you know, you always wonder if there's something deeper, and I'll kind of direct this at Larissa, is that Dr. J actually had a Super Bowl party, and go to the party, and one of the ladies there I've known forever, I mean, because John's had parties, you know, forever, and she works out at Fermi Labs, and I've known her daughter. You know, I don't know her. I mean, I don't know she has a daughter. And she went to some school. She was a rower. Anyway, so I said, hey, how's your daughter doing? Well, you know, she works for Accenture. She's kind of a consultant in the systems area or something. And she's on the bench, and she's, like, really worried. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, well, the bench isn't moving. They're just sitting there. They haven't had, you know, and you guys know that, you know, the reason why somebody would hire an Accenture, a Marsh McLennan, somebody like that, is because if you have a big project, they can bring, you know, 40, 50 people that know what they're doing to your place tomorrow. And the idea is those guys do the upgrade, and a year from now they leave, you know, and so you don't have to hire all those people. And that's the beauty of the system. And I'm not saying it's perfect, but that's what they do. And the idea is the firms that have the bench strength on a Friday, they could say, I can have 20 people here on Monday. Well, we can't do that, right? Even the university couldn't do that, probably. So... And my buddy John Lee, who's on the show once in a while, he used to work for Accenture, and they did a huge 2 or 3 year project, all the software, like the Turkey Airport, the tower. They redid all those systems. These are huge sorts of deal. And I guess my question is, you know, Larissa probably takes a better view of the news than me because I'm always trying to invest in it. Have somehow, and I'm not blaming anybody, has somehow the U.S. name been tarnished enough where no way in friggin' hell is somebody going to give a U.S. firm a 2 or 3 year project in today's environment? Is it? Have we got to that point, or am I just making up a story? I mean, what are the chances of somebody from Britain or France deciding they want to use a U.S. engineering firm or a U.S. for like a 4 year project? I don't know. Is it been tarnished? Has it been not? I have no idea. I mean, and even today I'm looking at, you know, the administration's tout the idea that Japan is going to put all these, some kind of natural gas facility, all this foreign investment coming in. Well, I don't have a problem with foreign investment, but I go, if that good of an idea, why can't you raise $20 billion for the stock market? That's what it's for, therefore. I mean, is all this stuff changed to the point where nobody wants an international consulting firm? Nobody trusts us on a 4 year deal? I mean, I don't know. Am I just making stuff up?
Well, I have a friend who's in an international consulting firm, and she is not on the bench, so they are still getting work, but it could also be industry specific. So she works in user experience, and perhaps that's an area that needs more U.S. specific intellectual capacity. So again, I wonder how much that's industry specific as opposed to a general trend within the consulting sphere.
I hope it's not a general trend. I think it's fair to say that a reputation isn't exactly what it used to be. I mean, I can't imagine a Canadian company hiring somebody from here for 4 years, but who knows? They might still. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm over pushing it, but.
No, I agree with you that I definitely not a Canadian firm, but to some extent, some of those Canadian firms that have already been using the U.S. specific firms, I don't know that they would necessarily stop utilizing them. I worked as a consultant for a treasury consulting firm, and we had some Canadian clients. And granted, this was many years ago, but if you're already locked into a long-term contract before all this brouhaha started, you might not be inclined to switch because the switching costs are so great. And one of the, as you pointed out, the beauties of these consulting firms is that you can bring in 30 or 40 people. But if you have to find a new consulting firm, that takes time and effort, as opposed to a consulting firm that you have already been working with for years upon years. So that's different than necessarily completely abandoning those relationships.
Maybe AI makes switching easier.
It could.
Yeah, this is before I knew Chief was going to jump in there. I had to jump in before him.
Well, maybe
you know, one of the lines of thought there is that AI, because you know, AI might make switching easier. Also, might make getting some of the answers that they normally give you. And you know, I don't know if either of you have seen in the news, but there have been instances where some of the consulting firms have to give refunds for some of the work that they've done because they discovered that they just used AI. I forgotten which one it was, but I do know that there's a news item where that has happened. Well, so if the consulting firm is using AI, why do I have to pay them to consult when I can just ask my $20 a month ChatGPT?
Well, that's a there's always on the show, at least to me, and by the way, I blame you guys for this, not you personally, but there's every time you talk about something, there's like a million different levels. I never thought my thought process would be influenced so much by Kirk and Spock playing chess on a three-dimensional chessboard, or a three-level chessboard. There's always like different levels on every subject, isn't there? And when people talk about, you know, the current administration, we got this deal going, we got that deal going, we're bringing stuff back. I think there's a general desire for this group to do that. Yet, the other side, a lot of its execution is, if we're, the three of us own a mid-sized firm, and we look at it and we go, man, it looks like we're going to get some of this business coming back to the U.S., is the other stuff in play for us to, hey, there's a building next door. Boy, the way these machines look like they're available. Is this going to be real, or is it going to be a couple of months, or is it going to be a cameo? Can I get the financing? What's my lead time? Is it 6 months? Is it tomorrow? Tomorrow's maybe one decision. What if it's 2 years, 3 years? I mean, I spent a lot of time in an industry like that, and you can't just run a TV show one day where you're solving every problem. And the next day, forced the three of us to say, okay, we're going to go to the bank. How much are we going to have to pay? Can we get a loan? Can we raise capital? The process, the timing. I mean, on one hand, I wonder if the administration is doing the best they can to get their face there and essentially do stuff. On the other hand, shooting themselves in the foot as much as they can and letting individual people able to do it. I mean, are they favoring foreign people? Are they not favoring foreign people? I mean, I wonder if there's a consistency to this, and I'm coming to a conclusion there isn't, but maybe, is there, or am I just being wrong? Russell, maybe you can opine, if you're there.
I was going to let Larissa opine, but...
Larissa's teaching a class kind of like this, but is the time, it's sort of like the same as the consulting thing, is now the time for a two-year project of anything?
I think there's an awful lot of uncertainty in the world, you know, with respect to that. But what were we going to say, Larissa?
I was going to say, you know, it's interesting. The embarking of I think Russell's point, there's a lot of uncertainty. But I think if rates do start to come in, that there might be more opportunities for those longer term projects.
And we've got no visibility on what has this guy spoken yet?
Which guy?
The new Warsh.
No, Walsh, you know what? Warsh, I think he's
and everyone that's been I was in a meeting where this was discussed after I was on with you last week, and every you know
every guy that's been appointed to the Fed to that job or nominated or whatever, they've spoken publicly within a week of getting that. And I don't think he's spoken quite yet. So we just don't really know what he's all about. You know what I mean?
I think he's pretty conservative.
The way that he would want to do things is very different than, or historically has been different than you would think Trump would want. So you got to wonder what he said and what he said when he was interviewing with Trump and what he agreed to say that he would do and to get the nomination. And then you got to wonder, is he going to hold to that? Because once he gets nominated, Trump can run his mouth and be angry, et cetera, but he can't really make the Fed chair do anything.
Russell,
try.
We got to go to break, but be blunt. He's more like you're in my pick than Trump's pick.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right. He's really a Fed traditionalist, which I'm absolutely thrilled about.
I am too. I can't believe he got picked.
I don't know if he's going to act like he's like he has historically said he would act. So we'll see.
What do you say? We go to break. SP futures up 25. Nasdaq futures up 23. Real quick break because I love talking to these guys. We'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it. Or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right
here, right now, right now. Lone Wolf X, Taxi Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. And we're on the board. We have Russell and Larissa with us. By the way, here's a name for you guys. The Boom Session. Why Americans Feel Left Behind by a Growing Economy. The Boom Session. I like that. I don't know what it means, but I like that. SP Futures up 27. NASDAQ Futures up 119. We've got over in Europe, the DAX up 166.7%. Bayer falls 8% after proposing a $7 billion settlement in the Roundup case. FTSE up 102. Is that for everybody, or what is that? I don't know, on the Roundup thing. Kekron up 24.3%. These settlements, I'm always foggy on these things. Nikkei up 577. That's a full 1%. Hang Seng up 138.5%. Shanghai down 1.2%. Wait. I don't think those guys are, they're not up. It's the Chinese New Year. By the way, it is the year of the horse. I don't know if that's anybody's on the show. I'm the year of the dragon, so definitely not the horse. Asia stocks rise despite lingering AI worries. Oil down after U.S.-Iran talks. 10-year rate up 1 basis point, 4.07. 10-year rates have been remarkably calm now for a while. Oil up $1.59.63.92, the upper end of this new range. Ran up 164.69.06. Gold, a little bit of a bounce today, up 72. Well, some big bounce. Up 72 bucks, was down 100 and something yesterday. 4,978, trying to make it back to 5,000. Silver up 281, 76.35. Copper up 9 cents, 573. Foreign exchange, the dollar is pretty much steady. With the euros at 118.3. British pound 135. Crypto down 325. It seems like it's zeroed in around this 67, 68 number after being all the way down to 60, bounced back to 70. Now we're in the high 60s, so that's where we are. Real quick, traffic, weather, sports. Not much sports.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. It is 7:37 here in Chicago. And yeah, not much going on. Just tomorrow, the Bulls play the Raptors. It's going to be at 7 p.m. That's about all we got. Chicago weather, it is looking a little better though. We're currently at 53 degrees. We're going to have a high of 65 today. Going to be sunny and breezy throughout the day, though things will cool, with a chance of some storms early tomorrow morning. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 53 degrees. They have a high of 63. And almost a similar deal. They currently have some sun, but a bit of clouds and some rain's going to arrive in the afternoon. Finally, for Chicago traffic, just one accident that's on the southbound Stevenson, right around Central Avenue, causing slight delays. Otherwise, inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 25 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook is going to take you 42. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf Road is going to take you 44. The Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 29 minutes. And the Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 41 minutes. Back to you, Chief.
Guys, if you had a chance to... I know I'm shifting gears here, but I can always shift gears with you, the bow to use, because you're up on all this stuff. You've been reading any of these January trade reports in all these different countries? It's pretty interesting how the import-export stuff has kind of shifted around. Here's an article by Lori Ann LaRocco. Nice Italian girl. Dismal China exports add to freight trade slump for nation's biggest port. Port of Los Angeles, the nation's largest port, saw total cargo volumes drop 12% in January year over year, with the port's executive director, blah, 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 citing dismal exports to China, from China, I guess it would be, or exports to China is a prominent factor. Imports were down roughly 13% year over year, typically a period of increased freight ahead of the Lunar New Year, blah, blah, blah. Well, yesterday I was reading something about how Japan's exports to China were record-setting last month. China's exports to other people are record-setting. What are we doing here? I remember the scene in Hunt for Red October when the torpedo came right back toward the Russian ship, and the one guy looks at the crazed commander and he says, "You arrogant ass, you've killed us." Or what are we? Are we killing ourselves here? I don't even know what is actually the biggest things happening here in the trade, but don't those numbers seem kind of weird, Russell and Larissa?
Oh, I think they definitely seem weird. I think I've shared this with you. I have a very unpopular opinion. I would love for Americans to stop buying so many goods. So if we're looking at spending or buying Chinese goods, and we're now just going about it roundabout, so to speak, and we're paying more because we have to go through these intermediaries, I personally would love to see Americans temper their spending and spend less on this stuff and spend more on quality products that are going to last 10, 15 years. Weirdly, I was thinking about this morning. I have towels that I bought in 2004 that are still good. You know, these are 20 plus year towels. I also have towels that I bought 5 years ago that are falling apart. I would much rather see this push for quality and reduce our overall spending. And I think that will help with some of the issues that we have in the economy right now, because we have so many people overspending on things that they can't afford and wages aren't going up and prices are still going up. I would love to see some of that tempered and to help almost soften any correction that we might have going forward.
Listen, I would
before you got to let me go.
Go ahead,
because there's an important segue here, and this is something I think Larissa and I talked about on one of our drives. But there's a new area of economic study that talks about cheap goods keeping poor people poor, mm-hmm. and the idea is that you can buy people know what I mean by this, but you can buy a crappy pair of tennis shoes for your kid at Target for like, or let's say Walmart for like 10 or 15 bucks, and they may last through the school year if you're lucky. You could buy, you know, I had the same pair of winter boots. You know, I had those fun duck boots that everybody wore back in the 80s.
By the way, they were huge last year. They were huge last year.
Well, no, and actually I say that. The other night, one of the lights outside of our house wasn't working particularly well, and I went outside in my duck boots and my jammies to fix the to make sure the lights weren't bothering my significant other. But the point is that, you know, you might buy $10 pairs of shoes over a 10-year period, or an $80 pairs of shoes today that lasts the full 10 years.
But this is actually an area of study that's going on now, that the proliferation of cheap goods that don't last keeps poor people poor. And it's part of the K-shaped thing that Dr. Ademiak likes to talk about an awful lot.
How much of it, when I got the right people here, because you guys are family creatures, because, well, I used to be taller, Larissa, but I always had to buy through catalogs because not many people had tall stuff, right?
Sure.
So, you know, so I kind of went through, I could give you a history of starting out with, God, who are the guys? They still got the outlet mall down in Michigan City. But I've gone through like four or five places, and as soon as they get popular, then their product goes downhill, and it's all imported and so forth. Hell, I think I might have started with Banana Republic before they got bought. Then it was LL Bean is like one of the latest. They're still pretty good, but I went through Land's End and God, who were the guys before now? Eddie Bauer.
I remember Eddie Bauer.
And every one of them along the line. Matter of fact, Duluth Trading is kind of the latest. They caught fire for a while. By the way, you know the latest now is caught all kinds of fire. They're probably going to downgrade totally. Is Carhartt? All of a sudden, now they're becoming.
Oh no! It's my youngest daughter got one of their sweatshirts for Valentine's Day. So they're not on the way down yet.
They now are being marketed like in all these different places where they're just going to have to. Anyway, so but the point being is every one of these catalogs at one point, Larissa. Duluth Trading being the last. If you went to look for blue jeans, they're, you know, $40-$50. Every one of them, going back to old Bean Land's End, had an American-made khakis and blue jeans that were, you know, higher quality, $75. They lasted at every place, I almost calculated exactly, year and a half in the catalog, and they pulled them out. Nobody bought them. I mean, they just didn't. And I've always been somebody who, I'm actually, believe it or not, I'm pretty good when I do my laundry. I've never been married, so I do it myself. I'm pretty good at taking the polo shirt out, and when it's still damp, hanging it up, and these things last forever. And one day I went to Old Navy, and I bought some stuff there, and I'm like, man, this stuff's awful cheap. Well, of course, it was cheap. The stuff lasted like forever. But if I had four or five kids, and they're going to lose it like every week or tear it up or go play football in it like we used to do, I don't know if I'm going to buy a Ralph Lauren shirt for my 4-year-old to go out and play football. I mean, somehow or another, on some level, it's one thing to say, yes, the $80 boot is much better. It's quite another to walk in with four kids and say, I only got $100 to spend. I mean, and that's kind of where we're at. And I don't think that there's any doubt that you're better off buying a better shirt that you can wash 50 times versus one you can wash 4 times. But I don't know how you make that call if you're the one who's broke.
I'd like to chime in about the kids stuff particularly. The also challenge with buying things for kids is if you buy cheap stuff, you're putting your children in harm's way. So, for example, shoes, if you buy the really cheap shoes, your child isn't going to have it proper foot support.
Oh, correct.
And it sounds silly, but you have to think these are growing feet. Right, so it's weirdly for me at least very important that my kids have quality things on their body. Right, I also am very concerned about chemicals and things like that go into the clothing. And so again, you know, they don't necessarily need Ralph Lauren; they do need quality clothing. So I'm very conscientious of also how soft it is. I'm very conscientious of how they feel, but I want something that's not going to rip. I'm less concerned about, because my kids like to paint, stains on their shirt. I will send them out with stains on their shirts. That doesn't bother me. But I don't want things to rip while they're roughhousing because I want to protect their bodies. So that's an important point. What I think used to happen, and this does continue to happen in some communities, people would buy things secondhand, or there was a lot of hand-me-downs that happened, and that happened much more organically because I think we existed in more of a community environment. So you had neighbors who would give you old clothing. you would pass it on, and so on and so on, because we don't no longer have that, particularly for families, and we don't have that naturally occurring. So, for example, one of the challenges for a lot of new, particularly moms, but families, you are very isolated during that time period after you have your baby. So the first 3 months of your life, we don't have a network of people that are your neighbors and family and friends coming to visit, because everybody needs to be at work. And when I was growing up, and I would believe that when you were growing up, most moms stayed at home, so you had that natural community, and it was very easy to say, oh, your kid needs an extra onesie. Well, my kid outgrew it. Take this one, and so on. And again, since our society has changed, we don't see that as much. So it is a challenge for moms, because we're really constantly not only thinking about the budget, but the quality of the things that we're putting on our children, because they're growing. And, well, darn it, we love our children.
Well, the what you just mentioned, Hal and I talked about extensively last week when we're not usually fighting about something. Talk about how you count all this stuff, and how when there was only one breadwinner in a family, sometimes the wife or husband that was at home did some stuff, but not full time like now. And but the amount of services that person did, say for instance, the wife, well, she didn't just sit home all day. She's cleaning, she's taking care of the kids, she's doing the laundry. Now, if you go to work, you pay other people to do that, how it's now essentially counted, and it wasn't before. It was always implied. Where actually, some of the growth in quote, the GDP, isn't really growth at all. It's just now you're counting it, and you didn't used to, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know how much that is, but we used to talk about that with Chris a lot when he was on the show, because he was in China, and he was talking about all these people moving to the city. And all of a sudden, now everything you do is counted. Where when you're on the farm, you swap, one guy had, I don't know if they have corn in China, one guy swapped feed for the other guy's milk, one guy did this, one guy did that. You're right. Women helped each other out in doing, you know, projects in the house, where because during the day they had some time available. Although there's not a whole lot of slack time when you're a mom, is there?
There's not.
I was going to say, it's not like there's a three-hour nap every afternoon.
No. And usually that three-hour nap, you are cleaning the house, prepping dinner. If you're lucky, you might get a shower.
Yeah. But I'm saying now, but economically, none of that was counted. Now, right. Now it all is. If everything you do goes to the cleaners, if everything, you know, if you have a babysitter, if you used to be your own babysitter, or the lady next door did it. Went to a wake last week, and Russell, you know the guy, Bob Giannone. He was broker in IBM forever. Good guy. Well, him and his wife had this, and I almost talked at the thing, but I didn't want to bring people back to, you know, the old days, because I knew him really well in the 80s. He and his wife had I can't remember it. I use the term disease. The kid only grew maybe 3 feet. Non-vocal, just barely alive kind of thing. I think he lost spinal fluid at birth, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to be fed maybe 5 times a day. And fed is even a wrong term, because, you know, put a spoon in his mouth, he'd barf it up. Maybe he'd swallow 2 out of 5. But, you know, the entire neighborhood checked in. I mean, the daughter, Jeannie, who's a terrific young lady, they were going to go out. If she was going to go out on a date, one of her girlfriends would come over and cover her feeding time. There were people in the trading floor that would stop in on a Saturday if they knew Bob had to go out and do something. There had to be 15 people that were in this loop, mm-hmm. that helped feed Bobby and take care of him. Then all of a sudden, you know, everybody got older, and he ended up having to go into a home, and he didn't last very long. But he lasted longer than I guess kids normally do at that time. But it's not about the story. It's about all that stuff was never counted. Now, if somebody's in some high-end institution where it's, you know, 10 grand a month or 5 grand a month to keep them, now it all is. But this is all, like Larissa's talking about, this is kind of free community stuff that people just took for granted. In fact, it's a serious economic stuff, isn't it, Larissa?
Absolutely, it is. And it's, as you pointed out, none of this stuff was counted. So we would really need to relook at the way we're measuring some of that growth from, let's say, the 1950s to today.
Well, it also begs the question, if somebody, well, it's just unfortunately, even today, a lot of this stuff falls on the lady because she's the one that can have the baby. If I was a young lady and was going to have a family, I'd be somewhat reluctant moving away from my aunts, my mom, and my sisters and moving somewhere else by myself and deciding to have a family. I mean, I got to believe that, you know, not that you can't do it, people do, but boy, oh boy, it's a lot easier if you got some support, isn't it?
Well, and most of my girlfriends and even guy friends, we didn't have any of that from support from our family or our neighbors. And the reason, even if we lived next door, if everybody's at work, it doesn't help.
Yeah.
So if everybody's, because we have both parents in the workforce, we're now in a situation where we're dependent on both of those incomes for the family to survive. And as a result, then there's not extra time to actually support another family.
Well, that's true. I mean, my grandmother, this is, I don't think anybody wants to go here, Lewis. So cover your ears. My grandmother said she had, you know, six kids. Said if she had a baby, they were all breastfed. And if somebody on the block had somebody or somebody she knew had a baby and was having trouble breastfeeding, she would augment. How's that forgiving?
I'll tell you a weird side story. When I was nursing my children, I found that there is a unique secondary market for breast milk.
Really?
Apparently, bodybuilders will buy it specifically for the nutrients in it.
Do you want to get the breast milk from some lady who's got big muscles?
No, the breast milk has a better, I guess, nutrient quality, different proteins and things like that. That's just not found anywhere else. So bodybuilders were looking for that.
Oh, God.
Isn't that crazy?
Oh, God. Of course, bodybuilders, are they the sharpest tacks in the box or not? I mean, I don't know. But...
Well, it was just one of those, like, you know, it's breast milk. It's you don't know that person at all. You know, if you're especially if you're buying it online.
Oh God! Hey, I have to go here a little bit. We started late, so we go over a little bit. The Epstein situation, and all the different people that are crumbling, our friend Wayne, I don't know if you were listening on Thursday, is actually writing a book about the whole Epstein fiasco. And his point is, it's 20% prurient and 80% really serious crap of foreign agents on our soil, somebody picking up information on important people. Nobody knows who the somebody is, starting really with Maxwell's father and the former Attorney General Barr, his father. Went back that far. Barr's father was in the evidently British Secret Service, and Maxwell's father started out in the Czech Secret Service, then he was a Mossad guy, then he was a Russian guy, then he was tied in with Britain. He was like a quadruple agent. The attraction for some people, you know, I guess they couldn't get a date, or they liked young girls, which I don't get that. When I was young, I didn't like young girls, but it also seems now it's poured over into, if you read about it, I don't think the guy who's the current Commerce Secretary showed up with his family at lunch at his place so he could run in the back room for an hour. I don't think that happened. I mean, Larry Summers appeared to need a date, but the lady who just was Goldman Sachs, she kind of liked Epstein, so I don't know if there was something going on there. But it's what was the attraction? Was it just that's where all the international money launderers hung out with this guy, if you wanted to know about what people are doing and how do you get money to Russia when there's supposed to be an embargo, did you have to go through this group? I mean, there's some attraction here that I just can't put my finger on. Plus, if somebody we knew went there and actually you know, if you're, I'll use somebody from Saudi Arabia, shows up and starts drinking all the booze and messing around with the young girls, which obviously the Muslim religion is not into at all. Who keeps the Rolodex of who these people are and what you have on them? And how often does somebody say, look what I got on you? I mean, there's a story here that's got to be 100 times bigger than kind of what we're hearing. And I just, do you guys have any thoughts? I mean, I know you don't know the whole routine, but what's your thoughts on that? Am I just being goofy here? Or seems to me that we haven't even come close to what the story is here, I don't think.
I don't think we have. And it's just, you know, I've never been a big conspiracy person. I really haven't. I also, to a fault, think people are good until they show me they're bad. And it's hurt me professionally. It's hurt me in a lot of places. So I'm kind of taken aback by some of the behavior that I've heard of that, you know, that is just explicitly, you know, in there, and just how absolutely disgusting some of these people are, you know, behind the scenes. As far as like the record and everything else, I'll bet you there's a notebook or a diary somewhere that's, you know, even more explosive than emails, et cetera. Because, you know, if you have half a brain, you don't email things that you don't want other people to see, because that's a permanent record.
Yeah.
So I would assume if Epstein was holding misbehavior over people's heads, that he'd have a bunch of people over on Friday night and Saturday morning before some people got up. He's got a little notebook out going, this guy did this, this person did this, this person did that, you know, and I'll bet you that there's like a comprehensive, you know, list of that none of us will ever see. Probably got destroyed as well, but I'm just so disgusted by the whole thing. It's just very difficult for me to even comprehend.
Well, there was a lady in actually, might have been a guy. Somebody went and did all these redacted things, and he goes, I think it was a lady. She said, I cannot believe the amount of women involved.
Yeah, that's.
But I mean,
I
guess my.
That, I, you know, I and like I there was a woman that I worked with at the exchange, and we had a really and she's like supposedly a big feminist, et cetera, and you know, I wanted to bring on a former intern that had done some great work for us who was really attractive, and she shot her down just because of how attractive she was. It was obvious. In fact, she shot Larissa down for a job because of how attractive she was. So, you know, don't think that women are all, even the ones that say they're supporting other women, are supporting other women.
Well, I guess,
you know, there are as many nasty women out there as there are nasty men.
Well,
their motivations just may be a bit different.
Well, the lady from Goldman Sachs, now she was in the Obama administration. Did she go there because she wanted to see? Well, Goldman Sachs is a massive multinational firm. Could be the biggest, for God's sake. Did she go there because she had to know who these people are? I mean, if you wanted to ship a whole bunch of money to Russia with all those different... I mean, I don't think any of us could go to the bank and say, send this to Russia. If you wanted to get it over there, did you need to talk to somebody in the room at Epstein's place? I mean, was that command central for getting around every rule? I mean, did she go there for Goldman Sachs? She go there for knowledge? You go there because you wanted sex with Epstein? Maybe. I mean, the motivation seems like it could be on any different level, don't you think, Melissa? I don't know. I mean, obviously, the guy had connections. I feel the same way when one of my buddies called me yesterday. He goes, hey, you know a guy that can do some work on a deck? And I go, of course, I'm from the South Side. I know a guy. Is that the same thing?
You know, got a guy.
You know, if I want to get money to a Russian oligarch, how do I get there? I know a guy. Was the guy Epstein or somebody around him? Maybe. I mean, that to me is way more important than the... Well, it's not important because look what they did to these young ladies, but...
Yeah.
It seems like... I'll be anxious to see what Wayne comes up with, because he's gone further back than anybody to Maxwell's father. What a character that guy was, huh?
Oh, gosh, yeah. There's a movie about him. There's a documentary on just how freaking crazy that guy was.
Yeah.
And apparently, you know, within days of him losing his fortune, about the same amount of money suddenly became Epstein's fortune. So I think Maxwell was a Mossad guy, and I can't think of the guy's name right now, but there's a guy that does the podcast Rounds that is a former CIA guy, and he goes, of course Epstein was a spy.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so I think there's some Mossad stuff going on there as well, where they...
All right, guys, we got a dash. S&P futures up 14, NASDAQ up 62. Great stuff. Talking to you guys next week. Always look forward to it. Nice job, Andrew. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.